Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Brian Lehrer's Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, March 16th. I'm Bridget Bergen, senior reporter in the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom, filling in for Brian today. Nationwide access to one of the most common drugs used for medical abortions may rest in the hands of a Trump-appointed judge in Texas. It all stems from a lawsuit filed last year by a coalition of anti-abortion medical groups and doctors. They sued the Food and Drug Administration back in November, saying the FDA should never have approved the drug mifepristone. It's generally been used as part of a two-drug protocol to end pregnancies in the first trimester, which is the first 13 weeks of pregnancy. Yesterday, attorneys for the Justice Department were in a court in Amarillo, Texas, on behalf of the FDA, along with attorneys for the anti-abortion advocates. There's a lot going on with this case in terms of what it means for reproductive health care in the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision last summer overturning Roe v. Wade, and the restrictions that could be placed on deep blue pro-choice places like right here in New York by federal judges across the country. Joining me now to explain more about this case and what happened in yesterday's hearing and what that means for your ability to access reproductive health care is NPR's national correspondent, Sarah McCammon, who is in Texas this morning. Good morning, Sarah. Welcome to WNYC.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what happened at yesterday's hearing. What was it all about? Who was there? And what are they asking the judge to do?
Well, as you would expect with a hearing, there were both sides had 2 hours each to present their case. And this case centers around a lawsuit filed by a coalition of anti-abortion groups, their medical groups, and individuals who oppose abortion rights. And what they're asking the Food and Drug, or what they're asking the judge to do, is to order the Food and Drug Administration essentially to take mifepristone off the market. And we should explain that mifepristone was approved by the FDA more than 20 years ago. Many major medical groups say it's very safe, has a long track record now, having been used by millions of people of safe and effective use. But this group is challenging the approval process, the way the FDA approved it, as well as some subsequent rule changes surrounding the regulation of mifepristone since 2000 when it was first approved. So they had a chance to make their case. Lawyers for that group are represented, which is represented by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a conservative legal group based in D.C. They made their case. And then lawyers with the Department of Justice argued on behalf of the FDA, who point to, again, the long history of widespread use of this drug as evidence of its safety.
Sarah, you're a reporter, not a doctor, but can you just tell us a little bit more about how mifepristone works and why it's become so commonly used in these medical abortion procedures?
Sure. Well, what it is essentially a progesterone blocker. And progesterone is a critical hormone produced by the female body. It sustains pregnancy. And without it, a pregnancy cannot progress. So according to the protocol approved by the FDA back in 2000, when a person initiates a medication abortion, usually under the FDA protocol with the help of a physician, they begin by taking the first pill, which is mifepristone, that stops that progesterone, stops the pregnancy from progressing. That is followed by another pill, and it's sort of similar sounding, but it's called misoprostol, and it's very different. What misoprostol does is essentially bring on contractions, bring on the end of the pregnancy. The patient takes several of those misoprostol pills, and we can get into this later if you want, but there is another protocol used, you know, across much of the world that's just misoprostol. Mm-hmm. However, when you use mifepristone, it has a higher efficacy record. It's a little bit more effective. And doctors tell me generally more comfortable for the patient, less intense cramping, less intense bleeding sometimes, and just more predictable at how the process will play out. So it's the gold standard, using that mifepristone pill first as the gold standard in the United States. According to the Guttmacher Institute, 98% of medication abortions involved mifepristone as of a couple of years ago. So it's used in the vast majority of medication abortions here. And it's also worth knowing that more than half of abortions in the U.S. are now medication abortions. So this is a very important drug for many people who are choosing to terminate a pregnancy. And I should say it's approved for within the first trimester up to about the first 10 weeks.
And Sarah, you said this already, but I really want to put a fine point on it. This hearing is not related to questions over the drug's safety, correct?
Well, it is in the sense that the plaintiffs, this coalition of anti-abortion groups called the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, they are challenging many, many aspects of the way the FDA approved the drug, and again, some of the changes that have been made over the years. Without getting too into the weeds, this pill has been controversial and politically fraught, you know, since it was first approved, and it took several years to get it approved. There was a lot of opposition at the time from anti-abortion groups, and there has continued to be. And over the years, as more and more patients have used it and the safety information has become more certain, the FDA has made some changes to some of the rules surrounding dispensation of the drug. So when it was first approved, there were many layers of rules on top, you know, above and beyond a typical prescription drug. Those involve things like how it's dispensed, who can dispense it, where it can be dispensed. And over the last couple of years, the Biden administration in particular has lifted some of those, although not all. And the plaintiffs are taking issue with all of those actions. There are about six different things that they're objecting to. They argue that the drug is not safe. They point to complications and examples of women coming into emergency rooms with cramps and bleeding after taking the drug. Now, it's important to understand that is part of the process of taking a drug like this. It terminates a pregnancy. It induces essentially a medically induced miscarriage. So that's what happens. You know, there's been a lot of concern expressed by these anti-abortion groups about the safety of women. And doctors I talk to say, if it's prescribed correctly, if the patient is counseled properly, if she understands where she is in her menstrual cycle, it can be very, very safe. Mm-hmm. And there are complications sometimes. That does occur. That occurs with any drug. But major medical groups, as I mentioned, including the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, have been calling for years for easing access to this pill, pointing to the safety record. And so they, you know, the overwhelming consensus among the medical community is that it is safe, not 100% safe, but it has a very strong safety rating. And that's what the FDA, of course, is arguing as well.
Sarah, I want to take a moment to talk about the judge in this Texas case. This is a federal court in Texas. I said in the intro that he was a Trump-nominated judge. Who is he and what is his background?
Well, his name is Judge Matthew Kaczmarek. He's a federal judge based here in Amarillo, where I still am today, after yesterday's hearing. And he was appointed by former President Trump, who, as you may recall, you know, in addition, there was a lot of focus on the Supreme Court. In addition to getting putting three conservative justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, former President Trump, during his time in office, appointed quite a number of lower court judges, including federal judges like Matthew Kaczmarek. Kaczmarek has a long history of ties to conservative activists. He worked for a time for a conservative Christian legal firm in Texas. And, you know, since becoming a federal judge, that has sort of played out. Just recently, just last year, he sided with a father, a man who cited his Christian faith in objecting to the Title X family planning program. That's a federal family planning program that provides contraception and reproductive health care for lower income people. He filed a lawsuit objecting to the provision of birth control to minors without parental consent. He said that the possibility that his teenage daughters, could get birth control without his knowledge and consent violated his religious beliefs. That case is still unfolding, but the judge sided with him in that case. And, you know, legal experts as well as reproductive rights advocates I've talked to accuse the plaintiffs in this case, this abortion pill case, of judge shopping. Liz Supper, who's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, you know, says because of the way that the judicial system works here, the federal courts work here in Texas, by filing in Amarillo, they were virtually guaranteed to get Judge Kaczmarek, who they believe would be favorable to their cause.
And can you talk about what he could decide to do in this case?
There's kind of a wide range of possibilities, and some of it gets technical really fast. But what the plaintiffs want him to do is to immediately order that the FDA pull the drug off the market nationwide. So that would mean, at a minimum, that the FDA says this drug is no longer approved by us for prescription for medication abortion. How exactly that would play out is not totally clear. There are a couple of different ways he could do that too. He could initiate essentially a formal withdrawal process or order the FDA to initiate one. There's an existing process, as I understand it, for taking drugs off the market that involves, you know, public comment, and it would take some time. Or he could take a more immediate action and enforce its removal right away. Now, you know, I talked to one lawyer with the ACLU in Texas yesterday, and he said that, you know, it's even unclear what that would mean, though. Who would it apply to? Would doctors have to immediately stop prescribing it? Would pharmacies who may still have it have to stop providing it? And those are just certified pharmacies. There's still some restrictions in place for who can dispense it. But would those who are licensed to dispense it be able to continue dispensing it while they have it? I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions. And, you know, abortion providers I've talked to around the country say they're preparing to switch to that other regimen I talked about, misoprostol alone, if they need to. There are also some other half measures the judge could take. You know, he could simply roll back or reinstitute some of the rule changes that the Biden administration made. I mentioned the Biden administration has made it a little easier to get the drug, for example, allowing it to be shipped through the mail. That was a pandemic era policy that was initially going to be temporary. And then the Biden administration in 2021 said, made that change permanent and said, you know, these drugs can now be prescribed by providers and sent in the mail, which made it a lot easier for people to get them. You know, he could roll that rule change back. So there's a kind of a wide range of ways this could go and ways it could play out. And everyone I've talked to said, you know, when the decision is issued, whatever it says, you know, they'll be reading it very closely and just trying to figure out, you know, what it means for not just the FDA, but drug makers, pharmacies, prescribers, and of course, for patients.
Let's take a caller. We'll go to Monique in Tarrytown. Monique, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I come from that generation that saw abortion to be legal, safe, and rare. And my concern is, first of all, on a safety issue, like, you know, any hormonal manipulation should be under some sort of medical care and also like long-term implications. But more importantly, the idea of rare, because my concern is that this could be seen as a substitute for birth control. But more importantly, it's a really easy way and convenient way to cover up abuse of women, either it be in rape or forced prostitution or all those other things that if there's a process, it can be uncovered. And that's where, how are those ideas, I know they're bigger than just the, how are those issues being addressed?
Well, those are a lot of issues, and but they're good questions, and they're things that I hear about in my reporting as well. I'll try to just address a couple of them. I mean, first of all, I would say that the terminology around safe, legal, and rare is controversial. It's you know, among the abortion rights movement, there are some people who like that kind of terminology and others who don't. There's been a movement, I think, you know, I think we all remember the Clintons using that terminology to talk about abortion. The sort of modern abortion rights movement, there are segments of it that feel that language is stigmatizing. But I think there's also an understanding by a lot of people that preventing unwanted pregnancies is always a good goal. You know, from a healthcare perspective, prevention is always better than having to cure something. So, you know, that's sort of my sense of the political debate around that language. When it comes to, you know, a substitute for birth control and a concern about increasing abortion rate, I mean, I would just say that the trajectory for many years has been a downward trend in abortion, and particularly over the last 15 to 20 years. I'd have to check the exact timeline, but, you know, there's been a large uptick in use of long-acting contraception like IUDs, which are highly effective and last for many years, and women don't even have to think about them, you know, if they tolerate them. Not everybody does. But interventions like that have helped to bring down the abortion rate. The teen pregnancy rate has gone down. We have seen, you know, a little uptick here and there in the last couple of years, and it's not entirely clear what that's due to, but the overarching trajectory is toward less unintended pregnancy and fewer abortions, which means that taken together, and I think there's some pretty good evidence that the Affordable Care Act, which required most insurers to provide low-cost or free access to contraception, that helps also increase the use of contraception among a lot of women. The overall trajectory seems to be that people are having fewer unintended pregnancies and fewer abortions. Would this access to this pill change that? I think what abortion rights advocates tell me is that, you know, this is an option for people who would maybe otherwise seek surgical care, or in many cases, maybe live in rural places, live in underserved areas, and struggle with access to contraception, and have found themselves pregnant for whatever reason. There's a host of reasons why people seek abortions, of course. Will it increase the abortion rate? I don't see any evidence of that so far. But again, this is such a rapidly shifting landscape legally that it's hard to totally predict what will happen. The question about abuse is a difficult one. I don't know if I'm really equipped to answer that. I would have to study it more to really be able to talk about the correlation between those issues.
Monique, thank you for calling and raising some different ideas and concerns as part of this conversation. Sarah, you also reported this week on another really troubling case out of Texas, where a Texas man is suing his ex-wife's friends for helping her get abortion pills. When I heard this Monday morning on Morning Edition, it literally stopped me in my tracks. Can you talk about what's happening in that case?
Yeah, so to recap, for those who aren't aware of it, this is a case involving a man named Marcus Silva in Galveston County, Texas. He filed a lawsuit, and he's being represented, I should mention, by Jonathan Mitchell, who is a well-known conservative lawyer based in Texas. He's probably best known as the architect of SB8, which is the abortion law that was allowed to take effect back in 2021, even before Roe was overturned. It was this law that allowed private citizens to bring lawsuits against anyone accused of helping someone get access to an illegal abortion under the law, which restricted abortion after about 6 weeks. So Jonathan Mitchell has been very active in these kinds of conservative religious causes, including this case. And he and others are representing Marcus Silva. Silva claims in this lawsuit that three women, two, it appears, who were friends of his wife, and a third who sort of helped them get abortion pills. He claims that they assisted her in getting these pills last July after the two of them had begun the process of a divorce. His wife became pregnant and, according to the lawsuit, concealed the pregnancy from him, reached out to her friends. They helped her get abortion pills because, again, at this point, July of 2022, you had multiple abortion bans in place in Texas. Surgical abortion was not an option. And she terminated her pregnancy in that way. He somehow found out about it. It's not clear. Submitted with this lawsuit were screenshots of text messages between his ex-wife and her friends talking about, her sort of decision-making process about what to do, thanking them for their help and support, talking about how they could get pills and how they could take them. She also expressed concern that if Marcus knew she was pregnant, he would try to use that information to pressure her to stay in the marriage. Their divorce was just finalized in February of this year, and the lawsuit was filed, just days ago. So, it has a lot of different potential implications. I mean, there's sort of the obvious one of this question of, could a man use anti-abortion laws to punish a woman for her decisions about her reproductive health? And I think there's also a larger strategy in place here from talking to lawyers, including one of Silva's attorneys and legal scholars. The case seems to be trying to sort of not necessarily set precedent for criminal prosecution, but at least create the idea in the public mind that these kinds of cases, illegal use and obtaining of abortion pills, can be treated like killing a person. It's a wrongful death lawsuit, which I probably should have said at the beginning. But this lawsuit is actually not it's not under primarily focused on an abortion ban. It sort of cites these abortion bans as evidence that an abortion is causing an abortion is a, you know, murder. It uses the word murder, and it describes this as a wrongful death. And so it's sort of trying to build the case that that abortion should be viewed in this way. And one of the attorneys I talked to for Mr. Silva said he believes prosecutors, criminal prosecutors, should also take note. So, you know, it could have a lot of implications, certainly for the defendants, certainly for people in, you know, who are, find themselves pregnant while in difficult relationships, but also more broadly.
We're going to have to leave it there for today. I want to thank NPR's national correspondent, Sarah McCammon. We will definitely be following your reporting in the days and weeks ahead. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.